This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
All right, guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. And if you're betting college football bowl games, and that can be a dicey endeavor, we're the podcast for you. We're releasing breakdowns for every matchup with new episodes dropping almost every day. Subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for having us. Looking forward to this inspiring conversation with one of my longtime heroes and someone I've admired for several years. But first, thank you, Darcy, for that kind introduction, as well as to Dale and the entire DRC team for yet again another spectacular event. Congratulations, Raphael. Great run, even for an Army person. That's impressive. And I think seizing the moment is going to be our new mantra as Cint, who is, again, one of my huge heroes, is going to lead us into the next generation of the chamber, and we're all looking forward to that. And of course, Elmer Craven, thank you so much for agreeing to be our keynote speaker today. It's a true honor and privilege for all of us to have you here, and especially for myself to have this opportunity to sit down with you. Admiral, I don't know if you remember, but the first time we met, even though I'd followed you for years, was actually last August. It was the Navy Notre Dame game in Dublin. And my buddies and I, my classmates and I, were walking down the street, and we said, wait a second, that's Admiral McCraven. It's obviously very, very, very noticeable on the streets of Dublin. And so we stopped, and we had a really great conversation with you. And so literally a couple of weeks after that, Dale called me and said, hey, Bob, I've got an assignment for you. How would you like to moderate a conversation with Admiral McCraven? And so it's a dream come true, and really, really looking forward to
Of course, what Bob isn't telling you is the score of the game.
That didn't turn out so well
for Navy.
That was not a good weekend. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. So, a lot to share with the audience in business and community leaders here that don't want to hear me speak. They want to hear you speak. So, why don't we jump right in? Darcy actually talked about this book. It's one of your several New York Times bestsellers, The Wisdom of the Bullfrog. Can you start off by explaining, you know, what it means to be a bullfrog and where that originated?
Yeah, so the term bullfrog is given to the senior active duty SEAL. So remember, as Navy SEALs, we are first and foremost Navy frogmen. So you actually start off as tadpoles and you evolve into frogmen. And then when you are the oldest frogman, you are the bullfrog. Now I know Navy Captain Chris Cassidy is somewhere here in the audience. What I tell folks is, you know, a lot of us SEALs, we're just like Chris Cassidy. We go to the Naval Academy, then we go to SEAL training, we go into combat, we decide we're going to go to MIT and pick up a PhD, and then we become an astronaut, and then after being an astronaut, we run the International Space Station, and now, and that's kind of a typical profile for most SEALs. So, and if you believe that, but Chris is here now running the Medal of Honor Museum. Chris, it was great to see you today, you and Peggy.
That's great. And Chris, congratulations on all of your successes as well. You definitely make us wonder what we've been doing with our lives for the last several years. Admiral, you have a motto in the book, The Wisdom of the Bullfrog: when you command, command. Yeah. What's the significance of that phrase, and especially in moments that maybe you're making some tough decisions?
Yeah, interestingly enough, the story goes back to Admiral Nimitz. And so when I was a midshipman at the University of Texas, we learned about Nimitz. Of course, Nimitz was born and raised in Fredericksburg, Texas. And the story goes right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and this was actually the summer after. So this is 1942, the summer of 1942. And Nimitz is trying to make the decision on whether or not he's going to sail what remains of the fleet, the Navy fleet, out to this small island in the Pacific called Midway. And all of his staff has convinced him that this is a terrible idea, that the Japanese are waiting for him at Midway. The Navy staff up in Washington, D.C. says this is a bad idea, but something in Nimitz's gut says this is something he needs to do. So he goes to see his old friend, Admiral Bull Halsey, and Halsey had gotten shingles and was in the hospital there in Pearl Harbor. And so he goes to see Halsey, and he tells Halsey about his dilemma and says, look, everybody's telling me this is a bad thing to do, and I just want to get your thoughts on it. And Halsey, who was this kind of gruff, battle-hardened Navy admiral, turns to Nimitz and says, well, Admiral, you used to tell me, when in command, command. And the point is, when you're in charge, you have to make the tough decisions. You got to take in all the best information you can. You got to assess things. But at the end of the day, as a leader, it's your decision. And you can't waffle. You can't be constrained by too much fear. As you say in the military, you can't take too much fear, counsel of your fears. You have to make the hard decisions. And Nimitz knew how to do that. Obviously, he sailed the fleet to Midway. It was a pivotal point in the war in the Pacific, and Nimitz went on to greatness.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
No, that's inspiring. Going back to your books, the one of several bestsellers, The Hero Code. Right. Can you explain what the code is, what you mean by it, and how this audience of business and community leaders can learn from it?
Yeah, a lot of times people kept asking me, who are your heroes? And some point in time, as I started to think about it, I thought, well, I'd like to write about the people that I've met in my career, both in the military and after my time in the military, and what were the traits that they had. But interestingly enough, when I started off, the first thing I had to do was define what a hero is. I was kind of struggled with that, and I thought, well, let's go to the dictionary. And the dictionary had a great definition, which is a hero is someone we admire for their noble qualities. For their noble qualities. And when you begin to realize that, hey, not everybody has all the qualities, but there are people out there that you meet that have these remarkable, noble qualities, that are honest, that are men and women of integrity, that have a sense of humor when things are really, really tough. But I started the book with courage, because there's a quote in there from Churchill that says, courage is the most important quality because it guarantees all the rest. Courage is the most important quality because it guarantees all the rest. But I bookended it with forgiveness, because I tell the story when I was in Afghanistan, we had a mission go horribly wrong where some civilians got killed, and I went down to apologize to the Afghan father, and two of his children had been killed in this mission that had gone awry. And I remember talking to my Afghan counterpart before I went down. And I said, what am I going to say to this father? I mean, what do you tell a grieving father that, your soldiers have just inadvertently killed two of his children? And I remember my Afghan general saying to me, well, he will forgive you, because it will not only relieve your burden, it will relieve his burden. And I went down, and if you can imagine being in a town hall with 200 angry Afghans, sitting down with the father, and he was this weathered old man, and I apologized, sincerely apologized, and he forgave me. And I often thought to myself, could I have been that good? Could I have forgiven somebody? And how hard is it to forgive? And if there's a noble quality out there, because today, you see, we find reasons to be mad at people all the time. We want to hold on to the anger because we feel like it empowers us. You want a noble quality? Yeah, figure out how to forgive people.
Wow, that is incredibly, incredibly inspiring and so pertinent, especially in just the polarization we see in the world today. No, thank you. Thank you for that. So speaking of significant events that you led in the theater in and around Afghanistan, you're commonly, Admiral, referred to as the architect and leader of the Osama bin Laden raid, which former President Barack Obama has said one of the greatest intelligence and military operations in history. When you reflect back on that experience, what are some of the immediate thoughts that come to mind?
Yeah, one, you know, I tell folks, obviously the Navy SEALs and the helicopter pilots, we get a lot of credit for this mission, and I'm always very appreciative of that. I'm very, very proud of my guys. But make no mistake about it, it was the hundreds of thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, civilians, foreign service officers, intelligence officers that were fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that deserve as much credit for the fight against Al-Qaeda. We just happened to put the punctuation mark on it. But when I think back on the build up to the raid and everything, a number of things impressed me. One, and I would tell you, irrespective of what side of the political aisle you might be on, and I worked in the George W. Bush administration at the National Security Council for a couple of years and loved doing that. But I watched President Obama and his team and how they worked in the Situation Room. Remember, this was very, very close hold. So there was just a small group of people in the Situation Room. And the president always wanted to hear kind of contrary word. Who doesn't agree with the fact that should we do a raid? And interestingly enough, it was split. And there were always a lot of kind of heated discussions, but there was never any rancor. I mean, there was nobody trying to stab somebody in the back. They were trying to do the best for the country. And interestingly, at the end of the day, again, I would tell you it was kind of split. Secretary Gates, I've told this story before, Secretary Gates was not in favor of the raid. And I remember at one point in time, after we'd had a meeting in the Situation Room, I walked outside and I asked the secretary to step aside for a second. I said, "Sir, I work for you. If you don't want me to advocate for the raid, just tell me and I'll back off." And what I thought was an incredibly classy move, he said, "Bill, look, the president needs to have all the best military advice he can have. And so you continue to advocate for the raid, not advocate, but continue to talk about the raid, and then he will make that their decision." And of course, the president at the end of the day made the right decision. But the other thing I tell people is we didn't know that bin Laden was in the compound. So can you imagine a president of the United States getting ready to send 24 Navy SEALs from Afghanistan, 162 miles into Pakistan, to a compound that was in a built-up area. There was 3 miles from the Pakistani West Point, 3 miles from a major infantry battalion, 1 mile from a police station. And oh, by the way, the Pakistanis have nuclear weapons. And you don't know that bin Laden is in that compound. And while we never talked about it, I'm sure somebody told President Obama, if this goes bad, you are a one-term president. And he made, again, when in command, command. He made the tough decision, and fortunately it was the right call.
So, Admiral, go a little bit, if you can, a little deeper into that situation. Clearly, you've got iconic pictures of that that briefing room that, you know, has the former president, Secretary Clinton, the then Vice President Biden, your briefing, your superiors back in Washington, D.C., but you are leading on the ground one of the most significant military events in history. Can you kind of walk us through, how did you manage that dynamic?
Yeah, well, the great thing about it was, at this point in my career, I had been a Navy SEAL for 34 years. I'd been in combat for in and off of almost 6 years at that point in time. So we had done thousands of similar missions. In fact, one of the reasons I built the plan to make it simple, fly in by helicopter, get the bad guy, put him on the helicopter, and come back. We had a lot of other options available to us. We could have parachuted in. We could have come in by, you know, hidden in the back of a truck someplace. We had a whole number of options. And I said, no, we're going to keep it simple because this is what we've been doing really since when I came into the fight in 2003. So it was this idea that we needed to keep it simple. And oh, by the way, you know, I had true combat-tested SEALs and helicopter pilots. So there was nothing, I would say, tactically difficult about this mission. It was a long flight in, so I don't want to minimize the difficulty, but it wasn't something that we hadn't done time and time and time again. So I don't want to say it was another day at the office.
Right.
I understood, obviously, the political implications and the historical implications. And oh, by the way, if this went south, you know, things were not going to look well for the United States. So we knew that there was a lot riding on it. But at the end of the day, I told the guys, look, you've all been here before. In fact, the night before we do a big briefing, and it's, you know, I was in the hangar and there's, you know, about 60 guys in there, and they all go through their role in this. And at the end, it's kind of like the coach, you know, you got to get up and say something. I'm thinking, ooh, I got to say something. Well, I like to play basketball, and guys know we used to play pickup basketball on Sundays at the motor pool. And so I got up and I said, how many of you guys have seen the movie Hoosiers? And of course, half of them raised their hand, and a couple of guys chuckled. And I said, if you're calling the movie Hoosiers, it's the story of this small town team that comes from small town Indiana. They go to Indianapolis and they're playing for the state championship. And the kids walk in, and of course, they're in awe. They're in this huge stadium. And the coach, played by Gene Hackman, tells one of the players, he said, measure the height of the basket. Says, coach, it measures, it's 10 feet. Says, measure the length of the court. It's 94 feet. He says, it's the same size of court that we play in our town. Just do your job. And so I told him that story, and it was, look, we've done this sort of mission 100,000 times before. Just do your job, and we're going to be fine.
Yeah, that's incredible. And just the level of preparation that went into that operation was significant. In fact, it's been documented years later that, and you've said it, yeah, 165 phases, right, went into planning the raid, and every possible scenario that could happen was attempted to be rehearsed. But Admiral, I got to believe that there probably was a surprise at some point, and if there was, how'd you deal with it?
Yeah, interestingly enough, there wasn't anything that surprised us, which was why we spent so much time planning. I think there's always this belief that, you know, as Navy SEALs, guys just kind of grab their guns and they go run and do the mission. Of course, the movies, you know, they're always going to show you the sexy part, you know, right, the guys on target. What they don't show you is much guys on a whiteboard with, you know, markers marking out the plan, because that's 75% of the mission is the planning. But at the end of the day, I mean, we had planned for the potential for a helicopter to go down. Now, I expected it would go down under fire. As it turned out, the helicopter lost lift for a lot of reasons and careened off into the animal pen. But we had plan A, plan B, plan C, and plan D. So nothing that occurred really was out of the plans that we had made. And I had a decision matrix set up so that, okay, if this happens, what decision do I make? What I didn't want to do was to have to come up with decisions in the middle of a tense situation. So once again, we rehearsed it, we planned it, so that I could make all the hard decisions, you know, sitting in my office with a cup of coffee long before the mission. Because I didn't want to sit there when things went south and go, oh, now what do I do? I'm going to say, okay, we decided if things go south, this is the decision I need to make. So nothing about the mission really surprised us.
No, that is incredible, and there are huge learnings there from how that translates into the business environment. So, though I probably could spend the rest of the evening, I can see that the time clicker is here, just on this topic itself, Admiral. Maybe just to go into kind of translating some of that, you know, some, not just the missions, but your entirety of your kind of your military career. How is that translated into the civilian world, and probably more specifically, and I know now you've moved on for this position, but going into leading the largest university system in the country in your alma mater, how did that work?
Well, the one thing you learn in the military, and I know it's true in corporate America as well, is you find the best people you can and you surround yourself with them. And I know Dr. David Daniel is here in the audience somewhere, who was the president of UT Dallas. David was the first guy that I hired because I knew I needed a strong deputy, and he was absolutely fantastic. And I could not have done the job without David. So David, I know you're here somewhere. Thanks for your incredible support. But again, I think it's true, and it was true in the military. You know, when I first got into combat in Iraq in 2003, I had not been in this kind of combat before. And the very first night I arrived in Iraq, we were getting ready to go do a mission that was out in Ramadi, about an hour or so flight from where we were in Baghdad. And the guys briefed me on it, and they said, hey, sir, there's a bad guy. It's going to be an easy mission. We're going to send a couple helicopters in. Ranger's going to be with us. We're just going to surround it. The guy will probably give up easy, and we'll grab him and come back. And I said, okay, I got it. Well, about a half an hour before they launch, the guys come running back into me and they say, hey, sir, the whole situation's changed. A lot of bad guys on target. Now we need 5 helicopters, more Rangers, probably going to get into a gunfight. I said, okay. So I grabbed the senior Army officer and helicopter pilot and the ground force guy, and I called him to my office. I said, okay, guys, look me in the eye and tell me you can do this. And tell me what the risks are. I want to understand the risks. And so they kind of laid it out for me. And I said, okay, I'm good with this. Go do the mission. And they did. And fortunately, it was a successful mission. But I learned a couple things on that very first mission that night was, one, you got to rely on experience. So whenever I was in a tough situation, somebody had always been in that situation before. Go find that person that has that experience, bring them in, listen to them, talk to them. All the books and all the training in the world, nothing wrong with that, but there's nothing quite like experience. And then you just have to rely on the troops to do the job. You can't micromanage them. Once you launch them, you know, they're going to do the best they can, and you got to rely on that.
Admiral, I think that's so pertinent. You know, I get asked the same question quite a bit, even though I did not have an esteemed career as yourself and four-star admiral. But as a junior officer, an 04 coming out, it is those types of experiences that live with you for forever. So thank you for sharing that. Admiral, I'm probably going to blush, even though you might not see it here, but I'll give it a shot anyways. You are the hero to many. Myself included. And, you know, we spoke earlier about this, but you literally wrote a book called The Hero Code. Who would you consider as your hero, and what do we all have to learn from that?
Yeah, well, fortunately, you know, I was raised by two great parents. And my father was an Air Force officer. He played football for the Cleveland Rams back in 1938, 1940. And then a bunch of his buddies signed up, joined the Army Air Corps. He fought in the European theater and then had a full career in the Air Force. And my mother was an East Texas school teacher from Grapeland, Texas. And they had those values that we think of as kind of classic American values, certainly from the greatest generation. But my time in the military, I mean, the people that inspired me every day were the young enlisted guys, particularly after 9/11. Sure. I mean, you see these young kids, and they are, you know, 25 years old, they're E5s, they're married with a couple of kids, and they are deploying again and again and again. And if you can't be inspired by that, I'm sorry.
No, Admiral, that's very well said. That's very well said. Admiral, let's stay on that topic for a moment, because it is. Seems like I might be headed down a direction here, but I'll even with my hero sitting to my right here.
Throw me a softball.
No, I will. But it is something that we in the business community and growing up in the military, you know, hold near and dear to our heart, and that is the younger generation.
Yeah.
And how can we as leaders continue to make sure that the younger generation understands and is fully aware that they are the future?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was often asked in my time as the chancellor, you know, what do you think about the millennials and the Gen Z? And I think my answer always surprised people when I said, I am the biggest fan of the millennials and the Gen Z that you'll ever meet. And I said, this narrative out there that they are these soft, entitled little snowflakes, I'm quick to point out that you've never seen them in a firefight in Afghanistan or going to the University of Texas to make a better life for themselves. This is a great, great couple of generations. You know, the older generation always thinks that the new generation is softer. And I've told the story when I was stepping down as a chancellor. They give you this wonderful house in Austin, and I was moving my boxes to our next place. And as I'm unpacking one of these boxes, I find a letter from my mother. Now, my mother passed away in 1986, and it was unopened. And I'm like, oh my gosh, and I see the writing on it, and I looked at the date on the letter, and it's the day that I went off to Navy SEAL training. And my mother had wanted to drive me to Navy SEAL training.
Something my mom would do.
And I told her, you cannot drive me to Navy SEAL training. So she dropped me off at my aunt's house, or she stopped at my aunt's house in Scottsdale, and then I went on. So she has written this letter the day as I'm driving to Navy SEAL training. And so I haven't seen this. She died in 1986, so I open this up. I'm real emotional. And my mother, again, she was an English teacher. So, and the women of that day, they tended to write in a little bit more flowery. And so it starts off, "Dearest Bill." I'm like, oh my gosh, my mother's handwriting. I can still smell the scent. And she goes, "You know, you're heading off to San Diego. And I just want you to know that I don't think you're up for this harsh military training." She goes, "You've lived a country club life. We live near a 9-hole golf course, you know." And she goes on and on. And I'm like, "What?" And she goes on and goes, "Oh, by the way, you're spoiled, underlined." I'm like, I'm glad I didn't read this letter before I went to SEAL training. But I realized that my mother, you know, who was raised, or, you know, marching 3 miles through the snow to get to school, to her, I was, you know, this soft and entitled little snowflake. And I thought I was the toughest kid in the world, you know? So I think this is a common problem, is the, you know, the older generation always thinks the younger generation just doesn't have the moxie to. I will tell you, these kids are just as patriotic as their parents and grandparents. They are just as hardworking. They are more entrepreneurial than my generation was. I mean, these kids, and again, I teach a graduate class at UT, and I will tell you, they think they can do anything, and good on them, because they think they can save the world and all the problems that we have. This is the generation we need. So, like I said, I'm their biggest fan.
I'm on that one. I've got a copy.
Admiral, I could keep going. I see some flashing red lights, but maybe just one more, because I know the audience, as well as myself, very interested in this. What would you consider as your greatest accomplishment?
Well, this sounds a little trite, but I've been married for 45 years. I've got 3 great kids. You know, and in the military, that's challenging. You know, we were moving every 2 years. I was, as a naval officer, you deploy as a matter of routine. It's not always just about war. Part of your job is to deploy overseas. And, you know, I was very, very lucky. I married the right woman early on. And, you know, were it not for her, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair right now. So if there's any accomplishments, it's because of her. And again, I've got 3 great kids. They're all married. They're all doing well. I mean, how much better can life get?
That's awesome. That's awesome. And Admiral, there's a saying that you famously spoke about at the commencement speech to the University of Texas. It's not "make your bed." I've used that one quite a bit as well, but it's one that I've really taken to my own life, and it is a statement that you make, that if I've learned anything in my travels around the world, it's the power of hope. And Admiral, thank you for your wisdom, thank you for your candor, thank you for your emotion, and thank you for all that you've done for our country and the world. It's been a real honor.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks.